I'm Mark Harshman. I'm the new Poet Laureate of West Virginia. Whether next door or out the ridge, there are names and places and faces here I know and trust, and that means a lot. Living in the foothills here just west of the Ohio River these 40 years has been a singular blessing to my work, has shaped it in ways that I'm constantly aware of. I know if I've been away and I'm coming home, I love seeing that first rising rump of the hill country. I know I'm soon to be reunited with family and friends, neighbors, my dog, or simply my scraggly backyard and that steep bank out there. And I see the locust trees and the cherry trees and the beach and even the tree of heaven, which is a junkwood mostly. But as metaphor, very true, these trees, these hills, almost heaven. But that's home, and this is a good place to call home.
As West Virginians everywhere celebrate the state's 150th birthday, West Virginia's Poet Laureate beautifully captures our sense of place and our love of home. I'm Cecilia Mason. Welcome to West Virginia 150, commemorating statehood. Join us as we hear from other well-known residents, as well as private citizens, on what it means to be a West Virginian, as we take a look back at West Virginia's history, the only state born out of the Civil War.
I'm Ryan Young. I'm 14 years old, and I'm from Daniels, West Virginia. There are so many really important people to American history. I mean, we had people from West Virginia that played key roles in the Civil War, people that played key roles in World War II. We had decorated veterans, the most decorated United States history. I mean, since it's West Virginia's 150th birthday, I hope it brings a little bit of light. The state was formed out of the Civil War, the key event of shaping United States history. Being part of that it's fascinating that this state came out of that key time period.
Shelley Moore Capito, Congresswoman, 2nd District of West Virginia. Reflecting on the birth of our state, the tenacity that our forefathers had to say, we are not the same. We are breaking off away from a philosophy of our mother state, of our large. I mean, that's a pretty bold move when you think about it. I mean, can't even imagine it in this day and age.
I'm Catherine Bergall. And I have been a West Virginia resident for almost 26 years now. It's extraordinary history. It's pioneer history. It's history of strength and courage, and all the stories, the struggle of freedom from John Brown to the Civil War to civil rights, really gives you meaning because you can walk in the footsteps of so many people and so many stories that are relevant to who we are as Americans and what we stand for.
Abolitionist John Brown's raid of Harper's Ferry, Virginia in October of 1859 is considered a catalyst that launched the United States into a civil war 18 months later. The war itself allowed the folks living in Western Virginia to break away and, on June 20, 1863, form the 35th state in the Union.
It's very ironic. Virginia secedes from the Union. Western Virginia secedes from Virginia. And Western Virginia will ultimately be found as legal, and secession by Virginia is illegal. And of course, we had a war over that. And Virginia loses.
Dennis Fry is chief historian at Harper's Ferry National Historical Park.
The Civil War was not the cause for the formation of West Virginia. It was the opportunity. There had been great division between Western Virginians and Virginians for years. Divisions over taxation, divisions over education, divisions over infrastructure improvements. And with Richmond controlling the purse strings and controlling where the money would go into the state, Western Virginia just didn't get much of that. And so, I mean, they in taxation, people in the Tidewater, Virginia, for example, would not be taxed for their slaves, but people in Western Virginia would be taxed on their cattle and the hogs that they had. And so it was considered that they really didn't have very good representation of the state, or that the state of Virginia didn't pay much attention to Western Virginia and its interest. Roads, road construction. It was very difficult to get money put aside for turnpike improvement or railroad improvement or canal improvement or river improvements in Western Virginia. But it was much easier to get that money that the Commonwealth had set aside for projects east of the Blue Ridge. In education, Western Virginians were very active in proposing and supporting free education for all. Well, the Eastern Virginians, the people in Richmond, felt that education did not need to be universal, that everybody didn't need to be learned, and that those people who could afford education should pay for it, and those that couldn't, well, too bad.
Shepherd University History Professor Emeritus John Staley describes West Virginia as a very sectional state, with each region being a little different. That observation is as true now as it was 150 years ago.
If you take the Northern Panhandle, it's probably the more diverse. And the Ohio River Valley, trade was with Western states. There are industrial beginnings. The prosperity was taking place along the B&O Railroad in the Northwestern Virginia Railroad. And it was the incipient lumber industry. The railroad monetized resources, is a good way of putting it. Monetized the timber, monetized the coal. Oil and gas was yet to come on a big scale. And then the Eastern Panhandle would be agricultural.
That sectionalism meant disagreement among those living in Western Virginia about whether to create a new state. Mark Snell says there were a sizable number of Confederate sympathizers in what is West Virginia today.
We look at West Virginia as a Union state, but West Virginia was probably the most divided state in the nation, more so than Missouri or Maryland or Kentucky. And that bears out through enlistment statistics. We know for a fact that about 20,000 Union soldiers came from West Virginia, what we call West Virginia. It's 32,000 are accredited to the state, but about 12,000 came from Ohio and Pennsylvania, very close by. And we know for a fact that about 20,000 Confederates came from what we now call West Virginia. So if you look at it that way, it has got to be the most divided state in the nation.
That division was illustrated when, on April 17, 1861, the majority of delegates representing all counties in Virginia voted to secede from the Union.
Now, most people don't realize it, but what is now West Virginia originally was comprised of 50 counties.
Roy Saville is an attorney and historian from Romney.
When the ordinance of secession was put to a vote, actually 24 of those original West Virginia counties voted to secede along with Virginia. Now 26 counties of what's now West Virginia voted not to secede, but geographically that was constituted only about a third of the state of West Virginia. Obviously, the eastern part down near the Kanawha Valley, Kanawha County did vote not to secede. A lot of central West Virginia counties voted to secede. The northern counties next to Pennsylvania, Northern Panhandle, and down along the Ohio River, pretty much as a block, voted not to secede.
What I find fascinating about West Virginia during the Civil War is that we've heard a lot of this talk about brother versus brother, family versus family. You see that a lot in West Virginia.
Mark Snell says there are examples throughout the conflict of West Virginians opposing their neighbors and family members.
You see at places like Second Manassas, West Virginia Union troops fighting Western Virginia, i.e. West Virginia Confederate troops. at places like Gettysburg. You see the 7th West Virginia Infantry fighting against, maybe not directly against, but in the vicinity of the Stonewall Brigade, which contained soldiers from West Virginia counties. Particularly in 1864, during the Valley Campaign, at places like New Market in particular, you see West Virginians versus Virginians who are from what we call West Virginia today. And as I said, in some cases, it's family members versus family members, friends versus friends. I came across accounts where one soldier on one side found an old friend who was dying on the battlefield and cradled him in his arms and basically held him till he died. So to me, that's fascinating. But also, you know, the guerrilla war in West Virginia, where people were burning down homes and pillaging. And just, as I said, people who had been friends before the war and now have these political grudges against each other.
My name is Scott Noble. I'm from Princeton, West Virginia. I'm a 13-year veteran of the United States Air Force. I served from 1985 to 1998. Over the years, my perception of the state has changed because I've traveled quite a bit, and I've grown to love it. And I feel like I came back to life by returning here, and I forgot the serenity and the beauty of the place, and it kind of helped in my rebirth. And it seems like once you're in with the folks in West Virginia, they become your greatest support group, no matter what. You need a car fixed or you need a shoulder to cry on, they always know somebody that can help.
My name is Trey Lockhart. I'm from McDowell County, West Virginia. And to me, being a West Virginian means you are strong and very compassionate. Many other states have more technology and have other things that we don't, but we've still been able to survive and go on through the hard times. So we're very strong people and we can survive through anything. And the compassionate part means when you go to a lot of other states, they're very busy and everything, and a lot of people just kind of blow you off and don't take the time out of their day to say, hi, how are you doing, or even acknowledge you. And when you're in West Virginia, no matter where you are, I think people always take their time to ask how you're doing and hold a door for you.
My name is Roger May. I'm a documentary photographer. I grew up in Mingo County, and I now live in Raleigh, North Carolina. To me, being a West Virginian means being able to handle tough times and come out on the other side as a better person. It's knowing who I am, knowing what I'm made of, knowing that I'm resilient and strong, and that I'm free.
While soldiers from Western Virginia sometimes found themselves fighting against relatives or friends on the battlefields, back home their wives often dealt with neighbors whose sympathies lay with the other side.
Your neighbors that you thought you were friends with before the war, they joined the Home Guards or they joined guerrilla units.
Connie Rice teaches history at West Virginia University.
And a lot of these people used the war as an excuse to make up for old hatreds, old disagreements, or even if they coveted something that somebody else had, you know, that they wanted, then they would go in there and take it and blame it on, you know, confiscating it because they were Confederate or taking it because they were on the Union side and they owed it to them. So you never knew who was going to take what you had.
Rice says women feared both armies, which were engaged in guerrilla warfare, and thought nothing of stripping homes bare.
There's several different women in their diaries have talked about getting up in the morning and finding, you know, 10 or 12 soldiers of whichever persuasion in their kitchen expecting them to feed them all day long, you know. And then the next time the other troops are going through, they do the same thing the opposite direction and want them to feed them as well. And it makes it very difficult because they don't have much food to begin with. But it was hard to keep food with both armies going back and forth if there was things available.
Rice says soldiers confiscated food from gardens, livestock from fields and barns, supplies from storehouses, horses, wagons, and anything else they could take. Diaries and letters written by the women indicate nothing was sacred. Soldiers also took personal items and family heirlooms.
Women have talked about, you know, at their houses burying silver in the yard, sewing things in their skirts to take with them. If they had somebody who they knew was a loyal Union friend, sometimes those friends would take their stuff in and keep it for them and try to hide it. Or somebody would come along, especially if they were somebody important, and say, you know, this army or that army is coming in, you need to move your husband's important papers, I will take them with me somewhere else, and they would send them on. So sometimes the papers would be saved, but things that they valued a lot of times they completely lost.
Many women became refugees, moving from their homes to places that were closer to where their husbands were stationed. Rice says women who stayed often felt unsafe.
When the armies were there, these women wouldn't go to sleep at night and put on their night clothes. They would sleep in their clothes all night long because they were afraid to go to sleep with soldiers sleeping on their lawns. They didn't know what these men would do, and there weren't any men on the farms to protect them. Or if there were, they were older or children.
While they didn't don a blue or gray uniform or march off to war, many women in Western Virginia found ways to help whichever side they supported. Some, known as camp followers, would go to encampments to be near their husbands, help with chores like cooking or sewing, or serve as nurses. Rice says as the North worked to maintain control of the region and promote statehood, women who sympathized with the Confederate cause often found themselves in the Athenaeum in Wheeling. That's an 1854 brick and cast iron B&O railroad building that housed a theater and served as a prison during the Civil War. Rice says these women, called she rebels, would end up in the Athenaeum after they were caught doing things like protesting or cutting telegraph wires.
There's one named Mary Green, who was just totally obnoxious every time she came into the Wheeling prison. Cursed worse than a sailor, kicked, bit, hit. She even talked one of her guards into being nice to her, using her feminine wiles, and then she hit him in the chest with a brick and managed to escape.
Whether they stayed at home or became refugees, camp followers, or she rebels, women found themselves taking over the duties usually performed by men who were away fighting the war.
I'm Jennifer Greenleaf, and I live in Charleston, West Virginia. Both my parents were born and raised in Summers County, West Virginia. And right before I was born, they bought some land down there. So we spent summers and vacations and Christmases up on a hilltop in the middle of Summers County, driving tractors and walking through the woods and just spending time with family. I ended up going to school in New Jersey and Virginia. And then once I graduated from law school, found an opportunity to move back to West Virginia. Sometime while I was studying up in the Northeast, I fell in love with my West Virginia roots and the culture of the state and decided that I really wanted to be a part of it. There's something about the people here and the pride that they have in their state, in their heritage, and the culture. And it's richer for me than what I experienced in the Northeast or what I experienced when I was out West. And I don't know, there was something about it that just kind of made me want to draw back to it. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that my family was still here. I wanted to really know where my parents were from, where my family was from, and have an opportunity to be a part of something that was bigger and richer than what I could do on my own.
I'm Barry Morrison. I'm an optometrist and currently living in Martinsburg, West Virginia. I was born in Montgomery, West Virginia in 1958, and my dad was a mining engineer and my mother was a homemaker. We ultimately moved to Richwood, West Virginia in Nicholas County. I had my parents there and the extended family included great-grandparents on both sides and lots of cousins and uncles and aunts, and it was just, I thought everybody lived that, like that. You know, I thought everyone had a big family, had all their relatives. And it was just wonderful because we'd come and go into everybody's houses, never called up, just kind of showed up, and you were always welcome and taken care of. And the kids would just basically turn out to play and You know, you went in whenever the lights, the dust of the dawn lights came on. Then you know you got to go home and have supper and all that, unless you heard your mom yelling for you, and then you had to get up sooner than that. But anyway, I'm just very proud to be a West Virginian, to know that that's the kind of people that I come from. And there's just so many of these people in West Virginia just like that. It will give you the shirt off their back and are just proud of that and just proud of having those kind of values and valuing each other. So, you know, now that I live out here in Martinsburg, which is surrounded by three other states, and much more likely to hear West Virginia jokes, I at first when I came and moved to this area and wasn't really subject to that many West Virginia jokes, I kind of took offense to that. Now I kind of chuckle and I laugh and I realize, you know, West Virginians sometimes are stereotyped in a negative way, but I choose to believe that most of the positive things that I found in my life really come from being a West Virginian and the family and friends that surround me here.
The thread that tied Western Virginia's most prosperous areas and made them valuable to both North and South were the rail lines, particularly the B&O, which ran across the northern edge of Jefferson, Berkeley, and Morgan counties along the Potomac River, through the Potomac Highlands and north central counties to the Ohio River.
The protection of that railroad throughout the entire Civil War was important.
Mark Snell is director of the George Tyler Moore Center for the Study of the Civil War at Shepherd University.
In fact, they actually had a railroad brigade, commanded at one point by Benjamin Franklin Kelly, who was not originally from West Virginia, but came to West Virginia when he was 19 years old. And he was originally in charge of protecting the B&O Railroad because it was subject to raids by partisans, by guerrillas, and by regular Confederate troops.
Kelly, of course, everyone should know from West Virginia, was a pre-war militia officer in Wheeling and a employee of the B&O Railroad and first colonel of what became known as the 1st West Virginia Infantry.
Dan Toomey is a guest curator at the B&O Railroad Museum in Baltimore.
He's the one that actually planned the Battle of Philippi, was severely wounded, and then promoted to brigadier general. And it was Kelly who commanded the railroad division, and it was his responsibility to protect the B&O Railroad from Cumberland West all the way to the Ohio Valley, Wheeling, and Parkersburg.
Mark Snell points out the significance of the Battle of Philippi. It's considered the first land battle of the Civil War and took place June 3, 1861.
It was a very small affair, only a handful of casualties, one of them being the Union commander who was shot in the chest there. But it was still the first land battle of the Civil War. And what it helped to do is secure the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad for the Union forces.
There was one wit who suggested that, what will we name this new state? And there are a lot of reasons West Virginia was picked as the name. One wit said maybe it should be called Baltimore and Ohio Railroad Company.
Shepherd University History Professor Emeritus John Staley says the railroad influenced Western Virginia's efforts to break away from Virginia.
As Waitman T. Willie said from Morgantown, Virginia had done everything the B&O that they could during the antebellum period. And so, however the war's outcome would be, the B&O did not want to be in Virginia. There was no doubt about it. The prosperity of West Virginia was tied to that railroad. And everybody knew what railroads meant to a society.
Rail cars became the spoils of war in the summer of 1861 when then-Colonel Thomas Jackson came up with a plan to confiscate some of the equipment from the Martinsburg rail yards. B&O Railroad Museum guest curator Dan Toomey says Captain Thomas Sharp was the officer in charge of moving the equipment from Martinsburg to Strasburg, Virginia.
Over a period of about 6 or 8 months, he moved 14 locomotives and 83 rail cars belonging to the B&O Railroad up the Shenandoah Valley via the Valley Turnpike because there weren't any railroads, and then reassembled them, and they were used for the Confederacy throughout the war. The locomotives were stripped. The flues, the lights, the bells, everything was taken off, including part of the wheels, and huge wooden rollers were put underneath. And then teams of up to 40 horses were hitched on specially made rigs for 40 horses and pulled. It took 2 or 3 days to make the trip from Martinsburg to Strasbourg.
But Toomey says while the B&O took major hits from the Confederacy, the Union had a clear advantage when it came to railroads.
The important thing to understand about railroad equipment in the Confederacy is they were completely underdeveloped and under-engineered as opposed to everything the North had. In fact, not a single locomotive was built in the entire Confederacy during the Civil War, and virtually hundreds, if not thousands, were built in the Union.
West Virginia owes its distinctive shape in part to the Union's efforts to maintain control of the B&O Railroad during the Civil War. The rail line ran through the easternmost counties of Berkeley, Morgan, and Jefferson, which subsequently became part of the state.
Hi, my name is Danielle Bishop, and I am a park ranger at Harpers Ferry National Historical Park. I have lived in West Virginia for about half my life, the last 10 years since I was 12, and I'm now 22. I love that people here are so sweet. One time I was at a gas station, I was like 16, I'd never pumped gas before, and I couldn't figure out how to do it. Like, I'd been to the ones where you press the buttons, but this is one of the ones where you lift the handle. And I talked to a woman that was like right next to me, and she came over and she helped me with everything. And I was like, wow, I love this place, because I really felt like I could do that with anyone here.
My name is Jay Rockefeller, and I came to West Virginia in 1964. I came to West Virginia as a VISTA volunteer, mainly because a friend of mine in the Peace Corps, Charlie Peters, he said, go to West Virginia. Life is hard there. And so I did, without any idea that I was going to stay here. I didn't intend not to stay. I just wasn't sure that I would stay. And I just, a complete outsider, you know, carpetbagger, people really had a hard time accepting me, not because I'm not a nice person, I really am, but just because I had a funny last name and I came from the most impossibly horrible city in the world. So what the heck was I doing in West Virginia? So I went to a community where there were about 150 people, no more. Coal miners. Nobody had a job. Nobody had health care. Nobody had school bus service. And just on and on and on. But the people gradually came to trust me because I really wanted to be there. And then they did the most important thing in my life, which was to invite me in for lunch. Then we spent 2 fantastic years together. It's a great happiness, you know. That's very lucky for somebody to have that, find something at the age of 26, whatever I was, to find that feeling. West Virginia was like getting baptized in a secular sense. I was born again in West Virginia because I love the people. Life is hard. People accept it. They go out and work. Sometimes it works for them. Sometimes it doesn't. But they never quit.
One of the main issues that had to be settled when Western Virginia broke away from Virginia to form a new state was slavery. To assure continued Union support from as many soon-to-be West Virginians as possible, President Abraham Lincoln allowed slavery in the new state to continue.
This is a political expediency on Lincoln's part.
Again, Mark Snell, director of the George Tyler Moore Center for the Study of the Civil War at Shepherd University.
There are slaves in the western part of Virginia, there's not that many, but Lincoln is going to allow them to come in as a slave state with gradual emancipation.
In 1862, U.S. senators debated whether to approve the 35th state, and that included a discussion about whether slavery should be allowed to continue within its borders. Senator William T. Willie of Morgantown proposed a compromise known as the Willie Amendment. The Willie Amendment passed on July 14, 1862, as part of the West Virginia Statehood Bill. It meant gradual freedom for all slaves in the state.
It can be argued that slavery, at least in Western Virginia, was less toxic, less corrosive.
Huntington native Cicero Fain is an assistant professor of history at the College of Southern Maryland. Fain says there was a difference in slave-owning cultures between Eastern and Western Virginians.
Western Virginia was categorized as a society with slaves as opposed to a slave society, meaning that slavery was never central to the economy, to the planter class relations, to the social dynamics. Slavery was much more isolated circumstance. And because of the isolation, because of the nature of slavery in Western Virginia, you really had small farmers, generally speaking, and you had yeoman farmers who really basically owned no slaves. That was the predominant population.
According to John Staley, history professor emeritus at Shepherd University, in the years leading up to statehood, the centers of black settlement in Western Virginia were in areas where their labor was most needed. For example, in the Kanawha Valley, where between 1787 and 1861, there was a highly successful salt mining industry.
Many blacks were brought into the Kanawha Valley to work in the salt industry. But most of them were not owned by people in West Virginia. They were released from Eastern Virginia. It was very common for Kanawha County salt makers to lease slaves and hold them for years and just send the check at the end of the year to the owner in Bedford County, Virginia, or so on.
It was the salt industry that brought the family of Booker T. Washington to the Kanawha Valley. Washington's mother and his siblings arrived there in 1865 when he was 9 years old, just after they learned of their freedom. Booker T. Washington worked there in the salt and coal mining industries. He eventually went on to become president of Tuskegee Institute in Alabama and played a major role in the early civil rights movement. Washington was not the only notable African-American leader with connections to West Virginia. There was also Martin Delaney, who was born in Charlestown. Delaney was one of the first African-Americans to attend Harvard University Medical School and became the first black field officer during the Civil War. And then there was Carter G. Woodson, the founder of Black History Month, who lived in Huntington during the late 1800s and early 1900s. Modern-day leaders from West Virginia include Leon Sullivan, a civil rights leader and Presidential Medal of Freedom recipient, and Henry Louis Gates, Jr., a native of Mineral County, who heads African American Studies at Harvard University. Gates is a descendant of another historically significant African American leader, Robert J.R. Clifford, who was an educator and newspaper publisher and the state's first black lawyer. Clifford was born in Hardy County in 1848. In 1864, when he was 16 years old, Clifford enlisted in the Union Army, serving in the United States Colored Troops. Harpers Ferry National Historical Park Ranger Guinevere Roper says Clifford also co-founded an organization that was the predecessor to the NAACP.
The Nagua Movement was an organization that was started in 1905 with a group of African Americans who wanted the same rights as whites. And they came here in 1906 at the Storr College campus to talk about racial equality. He represented the state of West Virginia, and he was in charge of all the meetings and things that they had on the Storr College campus. And his daughter, actually Mary Clifford, was also involved.
Like Clifford, Roper is a West Virginia native. Her family has deep roots in Berkeley and Jefferson counties.
The Bradford side of my family were here in the early years, dating back to the 1800s. Also, my married name is Roper, and they were here also. There was a free African American by the name of James Roper who lived in Kernersville, and he was kin to the family, and he was actually a blacksmith, so very prominent. He was really making a lot of money being a blacksmith.
When Roper was a child in the early 1960s studying the accomplishments of African-American leaders like J.R. Clifford, segregation still existed in Jefferson County schools.
I was one of the students who helped to integrate Charlestown Junior High School. So I helped to pave the way for my son, for my grandchildren,
and I'm honored to be able to do that. And now the schools are all integrated, not segregated anymore. And I just think that's wonderful that I helped to pave the way.
I'm Doug Estep. Grew up on Trace Creek in Mingo County. My grandfather was a coal miner. My family were mostly miners, but I grew up in southern West Virginia, eventually went to WVU. It's something that gets kind of in your DNA. It's something intangible. When you're a West Virginian, you're always going to be proud of that. And for most people, I think as rough as things were, you know, it was tough before my time, before the Union, you know, I mean, things were really tough in the southern fields, and people grew up poor. They grew up hard in the coal camps. But there is, I think, universally, people have good memories because there was this sense of community that you don't find anywhere else. There was a sense that you belonged. And so I think that's a big part of it. And I don't know. I think there's also some sort of imprint from the mountains, from living down there in the deep hills, you know, down in the hollows and all. I think that kind of gets in your DNA too. I remember going to Richmond or other places in the winter sometimes, and the sun would be out late in the evening and you'd have the long shadows, and it was just kind of foreign after you've been down there. So I think that pulls you back too.
My name is Fred Powers. I am from Brush Fork, West Virginia, right outside of Bluefield. I am 61 years old and I've lived here all my life. I am very proud to be a West Virginian, especially proud growing up in a coal mining culture and working in the mines myself. Having seen these men when I was younger, walking to work and back every day, carrying their buckets, swinging their buckets, some of them talking and joking and some of them more serious and going in there, and seeing them come out of the mines, their faces so black you couldn't tell who they were, day in and day out, and they would tell these horrendous stories of danger day after day, and they just going back the next day. True West Virginians are very hardworking, God-fearing people, and if you look at our records for the veterans, West Virginia is one of the top states in the country for small population in proportion to the population that's been in the military during war times. I just have a lot of respect for the men and women of the state, the women who helped raise the families and done all the work and held everything together in very, very incredulous situations, including my mother.
Virginia's western counties were rich with resources when the Civil War broke out, but the director of the George Tyler Moore Center for the Study of the Civil War at Shepherd University, Mark Snell, points out the war preceded the initial boom of the coal mining industry.
There was some coal mining, of course. I found records of Union soldiers fighting in West Virginia regiments who listed their occupations as coal miners. But coal doesn't become important to the West Virginia economy until decades after the Civil War.
After the Civil War, this whole area opened up with the Industrial Revolution that was here.
Judy Byers is director of the Frank and Jane Gabor West Virginia Folklife Center at Fairmont State University.
Very, very rich, with first having the lumbering industry, and then on its wake, you must have lumber to lay then the railroad tracks. The railroad industry must be there to take out the coal, the gas, the oil. So you see, the atmosphere was right, the environment, for this second huge enclave of people who came, the Southern and the Eastern Europeans. And they brought with them very powerful and proud traditions. But interestingly enough, these people were also from hill environments. The Carpathians for the people from Eastern Europe, and La Sila, the Grand Sila, the small Petite Sila of Southern Italy. And because of that, I really have a belief that hill people are the same everywhere. And so they've come into this hill area, these Appalachians, these Allegheny Mountains, and I do believe it was easier for them to acclimate themselves. And so they survive. So today, we have an incredibly rich, I call it a stew of cultures.
As coal historian Doug Estep explains, a Confederate soldier named Jedediah Hotchkiss promoted the first post-war coal boom.
He was an engineer on Stonewall Jackson's staff and a map maker, and he also worked a lot with Lee. And he came up the Gauley River up to a near Gauley Bridge on one of the raids, and he saw the coal and he saw the potential. And he ended up being really the catalyst that got the railroads and investors interested in southern West Virginia. He had this vision that he would take southern West Virginia coal and southwest Virginia iron, and he would combine them to a new Pittsburgh in the mountains. And so after the Civil War, about 10 years after, he started promoting West Virginia coal.
Estep says the rise of coal meant a lot of people needed to come to West Virginia to work in the mines.
So, of course, they went out and recruited workers. They went to the South and African Americans out of the Carolinas and Alabama. They went up to Boston and New York to the docks, and there were huge influxes of immigrants who came in.
The late 1800s and early 1900s brought waves of immigrants to West Virginia from many countries with the promise of work in mines and factories, as well as jobs and businesses that supported the growing communities. Two such families were the Rahals and Mansions. Third District Congressman Nick Rahal traces his family to Lebanon, where both his grandfathers were born.
My paternal grandfather came here about 1902 with perhaps a quarter in his pocket. He started pack peddling through the coal camps and hills and hollows of southern West Virginia. He sold off of his back linens that were made in the old country. And he would sell these to coal miners' families. And he did this for a decade before he went back to Lebanon in 1912 and brought his wife to America for the first time later that year. So I'm proud of that family history. It's the typical American dream come true, working their way up through hard work, as I say, which characterizes so many West Virginians and characterizes so many immigrants to our country. And it's that characteristic that has been instilled in our family over the decades, over the centuries, if you will. And that's also blends in very well with the true character of what West Virginia is all about, and what it means to be a West Virginian.
Senator Joe Manchin is a second-generation Italian and Czechoslovakian American. Manchin grew up in Farmington in Marion County. His mother's family had a little grocery store in Rachel, and his father's family had a similar grocery in Farmington.
But everybody worked in the mines when they first came. My grandfather started working in the mines when he was 9 to 10 years of age. And we had pictures of him with a mule, and he would go in and he'd have to blast and cut and load his own coal and bring it out with a mule. And my grandfather did the same up in Rachel. And then they evolved into the business world from there.
Manchin says his grandparents were proud to be Americans, so proud they would not let their children speak any language but English, and they believe strongly in giving back to their communities.
My grandfather started a volunteer fire department in Farmington. You know, he just wanted to be involved. They were just so appreciative of being part of this great country that they felt they owed it, and they still always felt that to the day they died.
I feel very honored and lucky, and we're all accidents of birth, are we not, to have been born in West Virginia.
Like Manchin, Judy Byers' grandparents were Italian immigrants.
My grandmother used to keep her wonderful naturalization papers and her citizenship papers right next to the front door as you walked into her home. Perhaps you could smell the Italian sauce cooking and see her Italian bread baking and her grapes in the vineyards in the back. But she had those papers by the door. She was proud to have been an American, to have had the opportunity to come here. And so I think I have been fortunate to have been born in that pride, in that tradition. Sure, I was born into an Italian-American family, but we were always a West Virginia family, you see.
The family story of Markella Balassas Jeanette is another example of the determination many of these immigrants had as they settled in and helped build West Virginia. Promise of a mine job brought Markella's father, Tommy Balassas, to McDowell County in 1940. Her father was born in Greece, near the Turkish border. He joined the Merchant Marines and ended up in Rhode Island. With no home, money, or ability to speak English, Balassas finally found a job working at a Greek restaurant. Then he saw an ad in the local paper posted by John Genodopoulos. Coal companies in Jenkin Jones, West Virginia, were looking for miners.
They boarded a train and went to Welch, and John Genodopoulos met them in Welch. And after they got here and discussed things, there was indeed jobs in the mines, but John Genodopoulos had been hurt in a mine accident, in a slate fall. And he had reservations about the two younger men going in the mines because of all the hardships. And so he advised them against it. Now they're in West Virginia without jobs.
Markella's father ended up marrying Genodopoulos' daughter Mary in 1942. They opened West Virginia Grocery in 1945. Today, Markella carries on and shares the family heritage by serving traditional Greek cuisine at her restaurant in Kimball.
When coal came, really you had every nationality in the world.
Once again, Doug Estep.
There was a anecdote about Mother Jones being in the Fairmont Field, giving a speech to a large crowd, and Mother Jones could usually whip everyone up and everyone would get excited, and they really didn't react, and so she asked Fred Mooney what was going on. You know, nobody seems, he says, well, none of them understand you. Said, you know, you're talking to 10 different languages here, we'll get it to them tomorrow, you know, we'll have to translate. So it really did change the nature of West Virginia, and a lot of those traditions are still here. You know, I mean, you know, large Italian community in southern West Virginia, up around Fairmont, Clarksburg. You'll find Hungarian churches, you'll find Ukrainian churches, you'll find everything in southern West Virginia. So there is a legacy still.
My name is Brock Burwell. I'm from Harrisville, West Virginia, and I am the 2010 to 2012 Mountaineer mascot at West Virginia University. West Virginia is not perfect. And I think most West Virginians know that, but West Virginians will defend this state till their very last breath. And I think that's very rare, and I think that's special. Not every state's like that. When I was at West Virginia University, students from out of state were just amazed by the passion that the students had for the state and how much they defended it. And out of state students did the same thing after their 4 years of graduating. So it's a really, really special place. And this is where I'm from. This is where I got an education. This is where I want to live, raise my family, and I wouldn't want to be from anywhere else.
My name is Drew Ross. I am originally from Virginia, but I reside now in Dunbar, West Virginia. And I came to West Virginia 17 years ago as a college freshman to go to WVU. I fell in love with my wife, and she is from Spencer originally. And I fell in love with the natural beauty of the state after that. So girl first, state second. And absolutely, I consider myself a West Virginian. We've obviously settled in West Virginia, and we're raising our family in West Virginia. We have a little girl. There's a lot to it, but I think the heart of West Virginia is the people. I think anyone can come to West Virginia and be an outsider and be welcomed in, as I was, and be made to feel at home. And I think that's the warmness of the people and just the way that people are raised here and are taught to treat each other.
West Virginia's where I belong. In the dead of the night, in the still and the quiet, I slip away like a bird in flight back to those hills.
There's a belief that West Virginians always come home, and certainly it's true, if not physically, then in their hearts. Throughout the first half of the 20th century, millions of Appalachians followed the hillbilly highway, migrating to large urban centers like Chicago, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Detroit, and Baltimore in search of work. Among those who left, Hazel Dickens of Mercer County, who documented her love of the state and its people in song.
Well, I paid the price for believing, and this life I have's not one I thought I'd find.
West Virginia has also attracted the attention and hearts of some outsiders, like award-winning writer Lawrence Lamer. He first came to the state in 1971. Lamer was writing a magazine article about the region, so he got a job in a Beckley coal mine. Lamer has trouble containing his emotion as he describes the attitude he sees toward West Virginia.
There's a prejudice against Appalachia, against West Virginia, an intellectual prejudice among the elite in this country, and about coal. I mean, the whole civilization, industrial civilization, depended on coal. Over 100,000 miners died in those mines across America. More people died in those mines than died in the Vietnam War, Korean War. There's no monument on the mall to the coal miners, okay? And people now in New York, they sit there, their electricity, or at least a third of it comes from the coal, and a lot of from West Virginia, and they look down on people in West Virginia. They really do. They look down on the accent. And I, because I worked in that mine, I feel differently. I mean, I love West Virginia. I love the people. And I don't think they've been treated fairly.
It's been 40-plus years since Lamer mined coal and developed that deep affection for West Virginia and the people he's met here. It saddens him to see the decline in population and job opportunities that's taken place in many once bustling coal towns. But while many no longer see coal as king, Senator Joe Manchin sees hope and a bright future for West Virginia. Manchin says coal will still be important, but he sees great potential in the resurgence of natural gas and the development of other industries.
I think in the technology arena, we've done so much in technology now. When you look at Fairmont and the high-tech corridor that we have going on, you look at our colleges and universities, you look at our tourism, you look at basically a lot of the coal had dwindled out in southern West Virginia. You have the Hatfield and McCoy. There's so many opportunities. We've just got to have entrepreneurial minds that basically thinking of what we could be. We need young people to understand their acre of diamonds can be found in their backyard right here in West Virginia.
My frustrations with the state are that sometimes we have a tendency to stay in neutral.
Second District Congresswoman Shelley Moore Capito believes that bright future is achievable if West Virginians are willing to reach for it.
And, you know, people say that West Virginians are resistant to change. I think that's probably true in a lot of ways. I think we have to really up our game, because in order to draw that young person back into the state, we have to be more entrepreneurial and more willing to take risks than I think traditionally we've been willing to do. You know, I think there's just so much opportunity for us, but I think we've got to start grabbing it.
Governor Earl Ray Tomlin hopes the reform that's taking place in education will help the state diversify its economy and create jobs that will encourage the third, fourth, and fifth generation of those Italian, Polish, Czech, Lebanese, and other immigrants to stay.
Hopefully, well, there'll be thousands of new jobs created in the coming years. And, you know, a lot of people who have left West Virginia would love for them to come back home, because I think most people, you know, do miss the mountains when they leave West Virginia. And I think it's just a time to celebrate our successes and look forward to a bright future. It's an honor to be the 35th governor of the 35th state, and it means a great deal to be here at a time when we can look back, reflect on where we've been, and plot the course of where we're going tomorrow.
Evan Hansen, president of Downstream Strategies. For me, being a West Virginian has a lot to do with moving here and starting a small business, and the fact that West Virginia is a small state and there's a lot of opportunities to do something new. I felt like I was supported by West Virginians and my efforts, and that's helped me succeed.
Gwenever Roper, and it is so wonderful to be a West Virginian. I think it has a wonderful future. I think we're growing. More people have moved into the area. A lot of African Americans have moved into the area. A lot of Hispanics have moved into the area. So we are really, truly growing.
My name's Teddy Queen. I own Swiftwater Cafe in Charleston, West Virginia. And for me, to be from West Virginia, it sends chills up my spine. It brought me home from a faraway place, the people, the family values, and best white water on the planet.
West Virginia, a state born of the Civil War, whose children never truly leave. Again, Poet Laureate Mark Harshman.
When I think of this place, whether it's living here in Wheeling now or the many years that my wife and I lived on Sally's backbone, I know that there goes on here a kind of independence, self-reliance, neighboring, and husbandry that I value. And beyond that, I know that to live in West Virginia means to live in a region we call Appalachia. To paraphrase Wendell Berry, I find that region, in the sense it matters to me, is a place where, quote, local life is aware of itself. I've almost nearly always lived in such places. I know the name of the next street or the ridge and the creeks and hollows that surround it. I know the folks next door, and they know me. And they, too, know these names. And with these and much else, we can still speak with a shared language and a shared knowledge of community. This is what matters most to me about being a West Virginian.
West Virginia 150, Commemorating Statehood, was co-produced by Suzanne Higgins. We also had help from Chip Hitchcock, Russ Barber, Glennis Board, Ben Aduccio, Jessica Lilly, Ashton Mara, Dave Mistage, Aaron Shackelford, Chuck Klein, John Hale, Larry Dowling, and Beth Voorhees. You can hear West Virginia 150, Commemorating Statehood, on our website at wvpubcast.org. I'm Cecilia Mason, your co-producer and host. West Virginia 150, Commemorating Statehood, is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.